Today, as one of the side results, we will find out the answer to the following question. Consider the Schrödinger equation. And then you have, let's say, consider the ordinary Schrödinger equation. Now, I'll tell you two facts, and then let's see how they can be reconciled. One is that the time evolution according to the Schrödinger equation is unitary as long as there is no interaction with some environment or some measurement or something like that, right? So until then, as long as the system is freely evolving, like the electron, as long as the electron is freely evolving, the time evolution is going to be unitary. But then, as soon as some interaction takes place, we're expecting the wave function to collapse. It doesn't have to be a measurement, because no human needs to be involved. It just has to be the interaction with some other quantum system, some other system, which could be used as a tool to measure, but it might also be just some stray particle from the environment. Okay, so we know all about this. On the other hand, the Schrödinger equation is advertised to be this, which contradicts what I just said. Because imagine you have an electron, it's moving around freely, but now it enters into a region of a strong electric or magnetic field. At that point, we have the interaction between the electron, which is a quantum system, and the electromagnetic field, which is a quantum system. Those two systems might interact very strongly, because the electron, for example, when it hits a region of a strong magnetic field, starts spinning around the magnetic field lines. So the interaction is strong. We would expect that the evolution of our electron ceases to be unitary. The wave function ought to collapse. But that's not what we do. When we write down the Schrödinger equation, we don't hesitate to write down the potential here, which could be involving electric fields and magnetic fields. And we treat them just like classical systems, and our Schrödinger electron is supposed to keep evolving unitarily, in spite of the fact that it's fairly strongly interacting with some other quantum system. So how come? How come that this is legal? How can we reconcile the expectation that the wave function evolves non-unitarily, collapses, at least in part, if there's an interaction with another system? And at the same time, it appears to be legal to write down the interaction with another system, namely the electromagnetic field, and it's supposed to stay unitary. I mean, if you solve that differential equation, it's going to be unitary, because that Hamiltonian is self-adjoint. So if you integrate up, you get a unitary. So something's got to give here, right? Let's see how that comes about. This will also explain why the electromagnetic field has originally been thought of as a classical field. Why don't we think of the field, the quantum field theory of electromagnetism, in terms of photons? Why does it appear to consist of electric fields and magnetic fields that are classical? So these are the things that we will find out as side results today. Let me remind you where we were last time. We discussed that the excitation of the mode oscillators of a quantum field corresponds to the creation of particles. The annihilation of particles corresponds to the de-excitation of these harmonic oscillators. Based on that, we asked, how can a harmonic oscillator get excited? And we said, well, there are two basic mechanisms. You can either have a time-varying driving force that shakes the harmonic oscillator, or alternatively, you could have that the spring constant of the harmonic oscillator is time dependent. So you could have that the omega, the frequency, is time dependent. For example, you could change the length of a pendulum while the pendulum is swinging. This can actually excite the pendulum. It can also de-excite the pendulum. So this would be parametric driving, and this is external driving. For most of this course, we will be concerned with parametric driving, because that's what gravity does. Gravity will, in a time-dependent fashion, vary the frequencies of the mode oscillators of fields, of quantum fields. But the external driving is also super important, not so much for gravity, but for quantum field theory. In particular, if you have different species of particles around, as we do in the universe, then each species acts as an external driving force for the other species. That's why one species of particle can crash into each other and create species of other particles. So the time-varying driving force mechanism for the excitation of harmonic oscillators is very important, and in particular for the classic case of a charge and current distribution, a classical charge and current distribution creating an electromagnetic field. Now, you could do this entirely classically, but we did the calculation last time, quantum field theoretically. So we treated the charges and the currents as classical charges and currents, but the field was not simply considered to be classical, but fully quantum field theoretical. And then we found that the Fourier components of the charge and current distribution, the Fourier components are externally driving the corresponding frequencies, mode oscillators of the electromagnetic field. So if you have a mode oscillator of the electromagnetic field of a particular frequency, if you want to excite it, you need a current of the same frequency to do this. Since this was true for all the frequencies, we said, all right, let's look at one of them. And then that will work the same way for all of them, for all the mode oscillators. So we looked at harmonic oscillators and drove them externally. So here's the prototype of a quantum harmonic oscillator driven externally. This is the Hamiltonian of the free harmonic oscillator so far. And then we add this term, J of t, Q hat of t. This is the introduction of the external driving force, J of t. Notice that the J doesn't have a hat. That's just an external classical driving force. In our example of last time, of Tuesday, in our example there, the J of t was a Fourier component of a charge or current distribution. But just generically, this could be any harmonic oscillator, such as a mode oscillator of a quantum field, or really any other quantum harmonic oscillator. And this is the external driving term. And we considered the case where the external driving force is acting only temporarily, where it's acting only from a time zero to a time capital T. And we express that by saying that J of t is zero outside that interval, right? So J of t is zero outside the interval from zero to capital T. It's like operating currents in an antenna for a little while and then stopping that. And then we ask, well, what have we done? How many photons have we created? We started out with the vacuum, then we did stuff with the antenna, charges and currents, and then we stopped that, and then we ask, well, okay, how many photons do we have now? And of what kind? Now, that was the bigger picture, but in practice, we are just calculating for one quantum harmonic oscillator its dynamics. And there are many ways to solve the quantum harmonic oscillator, because once you know the solution, there are a million ways of rewriting this, right? But a particular important way of solving the harmonic oscillator is the way we did it last time, because structurally, this is also how we do it for quantum field theory then in curved space-time. So the strategy for solving the dynamics of the quantum harmonic oscillator was this. We said, what are we really after? Well, we want to know what is Q hat of t, and we want to know what is P hat of t. So we want to find explicit matrices, infinite by infinite matrices, or operators of some kind. Q of t, time-dependent matrices, q hat of t and p hat of t, or time-dependent operators, q hat of t and p hat of t, that obey the right commutation relations, that are self-adjoint, and that obey the right equations of motion. That's what we really want to do. So we want two solutions. We want, I mean, not two different solutions, but our solution consists of finding two operator-valued functions, the q hat of t and the p hat of t. So we thought, let's try to solve for them in one go. Instead of calculating them separately, we can do this all at once. So what we do is this, we define a new variable, a of t. Now, in principle, it would need to have a hat because it's operator valued, just like the q hat and the p hat. But the tradition in the literature is not to put a hat on the a operator. So the a is defined to be simply a linear combination of the q hat of t and p hat of t, both of which we don't know yet. But we define a linear combination of the two where the p hat of t is added with an imaginary coefficient. And in this way, if we can solve the dynamics for this new operator a of t, well, then we are done, because from the a and its adjoint, a dagger, we can then recover what q hat is and what p hat is. So the aim was to reformulate the entire problem in terms of the dynamics of this a operator, whose purpose is to contain the information of both q hat and p hat all at once. It's just like a complex number encoding a real part and an imaginary part. So we rewrote everything in terms of this a. Now, clearly, we could have chosen a different prefactor here and a different prefactor there. We are just saying, OK, we consider the q hat to be the self-adjoint part, analog to real part, and the p hat to be the anti-self-adjoint part, which is analog to the imaginary part of this operator. But the coefficients here were arbitrary. We then chose these two coefficients, we chose these two numbers in order to satisfy two conditions for convenience. One condition was we wanted that the commutator between A and A dagger is simple, that it is simply A dagger is 1. This burned up one of our three choices of parameters there. And then we said, we still have one parameter free, because there are two numbers here, right? And we chose that parameter so that the Hamiltonian takes a particularly simple form. The Hamiltonian, which originally was in terms of the q hat and the p hat, can now be rewritten in terms of the a and a dagger in this way. And remember that if we hadn't chosen those coefficients in the way we did, then we would also have a squared terms and a dagger squared terms. Now we don't. The free Hamiltonian is particularly simple. All right, so we choose these prefactors such that the problem represents itself now in terms of the a and a dagger operators as the problem of finding infinite by infinite dimensional matrices a and a dagger such that they obey these commutation relations, and such that the equation of motion is fulfilled. Now, the equation of motion that follows from the Hamiltonian, the equation of motion of this A operator is this one, as I think we showed last time. Okay, so and then we actually solved that problem. For the initial condition, we said, OK, A at t equal to 0, we give a name. We give it the name A initial or A ingoing. And so A subscript in is, by definition, the A operator that solves all of this at time t equal to 0. It's just giving a name, right? And then we found that the full solution, and you shouldn't be surprised that we can get then that we can give the full solution because it's a harmonic oscillator, but it should be a surprise that we can do it even though we have an arbitrary driving force. So this is the complete solution to the problem for an arbitrary driving force. The complete solution is that a of t is this initial a in multiplied with this phase factor plus identity operator times something and then the same phase factor here and then that complex number, which depends on t. This is the driving force. And so we have to integrate the driving force multiplied with this phase factor over the time interval from zero when the driving force starts until the current time t. We can rewrite this also in this form, just in a more compact way. This integral obviously is going to be super important because it encodes what the driving force achieves.
And remember, we compared this to a Fourier transform. It's basically a Fourier transform. We have some function, namely the driving force as a function of time, and then we have the typical Fourier factor, and we integrate that. Now, if this was an integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, then this would be literally the Fourier transform of the driving force at the frequency omega. And that's exactly what it would be. But we are only integrating from zero to the current time t. In other words, what we are picking up here is the Fourier coefficient of the driving force evaluated, it's the Fourier transform of the driving force evaluated at the frequency omega, at the resonance frequency omega of our harmonic oscillator, but where we're not fully integrating over the entire time interval, but only on part of it. Now, since this term is going to be super important, it's going to deserve its own name. So that integral integrated from zero all the way until the force stops acting. So the integral from zero to capital T, we also incorporate that prefactor here. That integral, all of this is called J0, multiplied with the identity. So again, if the force acted forever, then we would have here integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, and this would be literally the Fourier transform of the driving force evaluated at the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. Actually, it is, right? Because we could equally write here the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, and it would be the same number. Because our function is vanishing, the driving force is by assumption vanishing before zero and after capital T. So therefore, this is actually the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity. It actually is that. And therefore, J0 is the component that the Fourier transform has, the value that the Fourier transform of the driving force has at the resonance frequency. It's going to be super important because it turns out that when you drive a quantum harmonic oscillator for a while, and then you ask, how much impact did it have? How much is it still oscillating? What's its amplitude after I'm done with the driving? What's its excitation level? All of those things would be functions of J0. Like, how much energy have I pumped into the harmonic oscillator by driving it for a while? Only all of that is going to be functions of J0. And J0 is the Fourier component of the driving force at the resonance frequency. This tells us something very important. If, for example, you want to drive a harmonic oscillator with at some external driving force J, and you want to avoid that it actually gets excited in the process, then there's a trick. You simply omit
in the driving force function, you omit the frequency, the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. Then while you're driving the harmonic oscillator, it will react. But when you're done driving, the harmonic oscillator will be back in its ground state. Right? Because the J naught will be zero. No Fourier component. Okay, so if you can do that, then you will not excite the harmonic oscillator. Conversely, if you want to excite your harmonic oscillator as much as possible, well then, you need to make that J naught as large as possible. And for that, you need this thing to be resonant with that. Right? Basically, the J has to have a, it has to be the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. That's the phenomenon of resonance there. Now, you can't have complete resonance because, by assumption, the driving force only acts for a finite amount of time. So it cannot be monochromatic. A monochromatic driving force that has exactly a sharp frequency would always have to have the same frequency. The switching on and switching off process is messing with that. That's the time frequency uncertainty principle again. Okay, so let's keep an eye on this J naught because it's the Fourier it's the amount of resonance frequency, it's the amount of resonance frequency that the driving force has in it. All right, so how does our solution look like now? Remember, here is the complete solution as a function of t. And it's this integral here where it runs up to t. But at early times, this is super simple because at early times, before time t equals zero, that term is not present at all. So we have that at early times, a of t is simply the initial a times e to the power minus I omega t. That thing hasn't kicked in yet. In principle, we should have a theta function in t in here. And then during the driving, so in the time interval from 0 to capital T, this is the formula. And then after the driving is done, things become simple again. Because then this integral doesn't change anymore, right? Because once the little t exceeds capital T, the driving force function is 0. So therefore, the value of that integral doesn't change anymore. It becomes J naught and stays J naught. So therefore, at times larger than capital T, the solution is A in times this phase factor plus J naught times this phase factor, right? Because it's A in times phase factor plus J naught times the phase factor. So we have the complete solution now in a particularly simple form before the driving starts and after the driving starts, after the driving ends. After the driving ends, the A of t is simply the initial A plus J naught. It's like this operator was just shifted by a constant times the identity operator. This thing we give a name, this new operator. Let's call it the A out operator. Because it looks just like the A in operator. The solution is just the same way, right? It's just that the A out is A in plus J naught. And it should be very similar because both before and after the action of the driving force, we have undriven harmonic oscillators. And undriven harmonic oscillators are always solved by this. And so before the force kicks in, this is just A initial. And after the force is done, this is A out. And A out is related to A in simply by the addition of a constant. So we have A of t, the full solution, is A in times the phase factor. At early times, it's A out times the phase factor at late times. If you pick up a book on quantum field theory for particle physics, it's all about the relationship between these A ins and A outs for various particle species and various momenta. Where the time where the driving force acts, our interval from 0 to capital T, is the time that the collision takes place. So at CERN, for example, at the LHC, they smash particles into each other, and then the debris particles fly out. And what we try to calculate is, if we shoot in such and such particles at such and such momenta, then never mind what exactly happens at the collision, we are asking, what bunch of particles with what momenta do we get out of this? So we have an in regime and an out regime. And the interval from 0 to t, to capital T, is the interval in which these harmonic oscillators drive each other, because they interact. All right, so the A out is A in plus J naught. And the size of the J naught, of course, depends on how much resonance frequency we have in the driving force. If there's no resonance frequency in the driving force, A out is A in and nothing really happened. Even though temporarily the harmonic oscillator was shaken, it ends up being the same as before, after the driving is done. Okay, so we have a complete solution here. If you just plug in the full solution that we had calculated here, this one, if we plug that solution into the equation of motion, then and please do that, then you will find that the initial conditions hold and the equation of motion, the differential equation also holds. But that's not the only thing we had to obey here. We also had to make sure that the commutation relations between A and A dagger are maintained. We have to solve that too, not just the equations of motion. Now it actually turns out that the canonical commutation relations are automatically conserved. But let's check this. So the claim is that if we make sure that at the initial time, the A in are operators that are like infinite by infinite matrices or differentiation operators or whatever that obey the canonical commutation relations, then given this dynamics that we just discussed, where everything is expressed in terms of the A-ins, you know, also the A-out is expressed in terms of the A-ins, then the A of t should always obey these same commutation relations. And in particular, the A-out and A-out dagger should also obey the same commutation relations. Let's check this. So here's the proposition. If we can find a solution, if we can find operators A in and their adjoint A in dagger, which obey the right commutation relations, then these commutation relations are going to hold forever, given the dynamics that we just calculated. And here's the proof. So let's assume we ensured that this holds at the initial time by writing down matrices, infinite by infinite matrices, that obey these commutation relations. Remember, we showed earlier with the trace argument that you can't do it for finite dimensional matrices. Okay, so let's assume that this condition holds at initial time. Then the commutator between A of t and A dagger of t is given by, well, here is the expression for A of t, and here is the expression for A dagger of t, where I wrote dot, dot, dot for j of t prime times e to the power I omega t prime. And here as well, right? It's the Fourier transform, right? So it's j of t prime times e to the power I omega t prime. I just didn't have space to squeeze it in there. It doesn't really matter what this works out to, because it's just a number times the identity operator here. And that's a number times the identity operator over here. Because, but this doesn't matter because in a commutator, anything multiple of the identity drops out because it commutes with everything. So what we end up with is the commutator between this, because it's an operator, and that, because it's an operator. But you see, this comes with a prefactor e to the power minus I omega t, and that has a prefactor of plus I omega t, because this is the adjoint of that, right? This is A dagger, this is A. So then let's collect these things. We have the commutator of this with that. This is number valued, so we can pull this out of the commutator, and then we just have the commutator between A in and A in dagger, and these two factors which cancel each other, and therefore it's one. So the commutation relations are conserved in time. Remember, we introduced the A and A dagger operators as substitutes for the Q's and the P, because we have only one operator A to worry about here. And then once we have its dynamics, and we now have it, then we should be able to recover what we're really interested in, which is the Q of T and the P hat of T. So let's look at the dynamic of variables. We have that A of T is A in times this phase factor. We're looking at the initial period, right? So before the driving kicks in. So then we have simply this. And we recover now the position operator as a function of time. It's this expression. It's basically the self-adjoint part of A in. So it's A in plus A in dagger. So A in times the phase factor plus the Hermitian conjugate of that. And the P hat is, of course, the anti-self-adjoint part of that. I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that this all is true. And the Hamiltonian, in terms of the A and A daggers, takes this form. So now we have expressed the basic variables in terms of A and A dagger. The Q hat of T, the P hat of T, and the Hamiltonian. Let's look at what the Hamiltonian is in terms of the A ins. The Hamiltonian is omega times A dagger A plus 1/2, time-dependent things. But before the driving force kicks in, the A of T is very simple. It's simply A in times the phase factor. So the product of these two guys is simply the product of these two. The phases drop out, and we have that the Hamiltonian is omega times this. Now, this Hamiltonian is clearly an operator that doesn't depend on time. So there's no time dependence in this. A in is a fixed infinite by infinite matrix. There is time dependence in these guys, right? A in is a fixed infinite by infinite matrix. A in dagger is the adjoint of that. But these guys are time dependent. Therefore, the sum is time dependent. Therefore, the position operator is time dependent. And the same story for the momentum operator. But the energy operator, the Hamiltonian, is a constant matrix. As it should be, because there's no driving force. Since there's no driving force, the energy should not change. So now, Hilbert space of states. We need an actual representation of our A and A daggers as operators, as infinite by infinite matrices on some vector space, on some Hilbert space. And then arbitrary state will be a linear combination of the basis vectors that we used to generate our Hilbert space. Now, in order to find a Hilbert space representation, we can use the spectral theorem. Spectral theorem says that self-adjoint operators can be diagonalized. So what we could do is, we could say, I pick a self-adjoint operator, any observable, and diagonalize it, and then I go into its eigenbasis. I could do this for the position operator, for example. I could do it for the momentum operator. I could do it for the Hamiltonian. Now, remember that we work in the Heisenberg picture here. It's not a good idea, generally, to use the position operator when you work in the Heisenberg picture in order to diagonalize, to find the convenient basis. And that's because in the Heisenberg picture, the operators are time dependent. The position operator depends on time. Therefore, its eigenbasis can depend on time. Therefore, as time evolves, what do? You choose at every point in time a different eigenbasis then. You choose a different basis of your Hilbert space. That can be messy. The same for the momentum operator. In the Heisenberg picture, the position and momentum bases are not that convenient. They can be, but often they are not. But remember what we saw for the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is constant in time, at least until the driving kicks in. And the Hamiltonian will be constant in time after the driving is done. So therefore, that motivates us to use as eigenbasis, and that's super important also for quantum field theory, to use as eigenbasis the energy eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian before the interaction, and then later the energy eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian after the interaction. Is that going to be the same basis or a different one? What do you think?
Different.
Different, that's right. Because the Hamiltonian will change, right? We start out with some Hamiltonian, and then the driving force acts, and then the driving force stops acting, but then we may have a different Hamiltonian. Because the energy changed, right? Remember, we are working in the Heisenberg picture. In the Schrödinger picture, the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian is always p squared over 2m plus x squared omega squared half x squared, right? In the Heisenberg picture too, but these q's and p's, these x and p operators are time dependent. So therefore, the Hamiltonian too can be time dependent. It's just a it's just a different matrix if you write it down in the Hilbert space. So overall, as we go from the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian before the driving to the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian after the driving, we expect that there's a unitary transformation between the two. But there's a change of bases, right? Change of eigenbases, different operator, different eigenbases. So there's going to be a unitary transformation. In particle physics, that's called the S matrix. Okay, but here we're just doing this for a for one single harmonic oscillator. Okay, so here we're saying the Hamiltonian is time independent before and then again after the interaction. So let's look at the eigenbases of the Hamiltonian before the driving force kicks in. The Hamiltonian before the interaction is simply this. And the commutator is that. So now, how can we build the eigenbases of this Hamiltonian? The idea is, and I assume you've seen this, but let's just go through it very systematically because it's so important. So let's assume that there exists a vector that we will call 0n, which obeys that it is annihilated by the a-in operator. So if you apply the a-in operator on the 0n vector, we get the zero length vector in the Hilbert space. These two things are completely different things, right? This is going to be a vector in the Hilbert space that's going to be normalized. This is just the zero length vector, the neutral element in the vector space. From that definition, the a-in has the name annihilation operator. It annihilates that vector, so to speak. Right? We're just guessing here that this might be possible. We're just guessing that there might be a vector such that a-in acting on it gives it a zero-length vector in the Hilbert space. We'll have to see if we get away with this. Well, let's see. Let's assume there is such a vector. Then we can show it actually is an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian at early times, right, before the driving kicks in. Namely, we take the Hamiltonian at t smaller 0, act with it on this supposedly existing vector, and what do we get? Then we get its omega, a dagger in, a in, I'm just using the expression for the Hamiltonian, plus 1 half, times the 0 in. Which is what? Well, we have a in acting on 0 in that's annihilating it. The a dagger can't undo this. This is actually producing a vector of 0 length here. So what we're left with is just 1 half omega, 0 in. But now we recognize what this 0 in vector is. It is the lowest energy eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. You see, it means this vector is an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. And not just any eigenvector of the Hamiltonian, it's the eigenvector with eigenvalue 1 half omega. We know, of course, that this is the ground state. We recognize this vector. We have this rediscovered here the ground state of the harmonic oscillator by its property of being an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian with eigenvalue 1 half omega. So it indeed exists. This vector really exists. All right. Now, let's consider this vector that we obtain by applying a dagger in on the 0 in vector that we just discovered. And let's call that vector 1 in. Well, then let's apply the Hamiltonian to it. And we find that the Hamiltonian applied to that vector is the Hamiltonian applied to A dagger in on 0 in. Let's spell it out. This is the Hamiltonian applied to A dagger in 0 in. Then what do we get? We get a term with A dagger, and we get a term with 1/2, with omega 1/2 A dagger in. That's the latter term. The first term, the A dagger in A term, has in it A dagger. We know by the commutation relations that this is the same as A dagger A plus 1. So this is A dagger A plus 1. I'm just rewriting A dagger as A dagger A plus 1. Now, this A in acts on the 0 in, which annihilates it, and we're just left with this term here. Therefore, we obtain that the action of the Hamiltonian on this state gives us omega 3/2 A dagger 0 in. And there should be an in here. So we recognize this state, of course. This is the first excited state of the harmonic oscillator. Is this vector normalized? Let's check. So we take 0 in, 1 in, 1 in. We spell it out what it is by definition. It's A dagger in acting on 0 in. And here the conjugate of it. And then the A dagger can be written as A dagger A plus 1. This term annihilates. We're just left with the 1 here. And since we assume this vector to have length 1, yes, this vector is normalized as well. I'm assuming you've seen this kind of calculation before. So how does this continue? Well, we can define now a whole bunch of vectors, infinitely many of them, by applying the A dagger in n times for n integers on the 0 in vector with the suitable prefactor that will ensure normalization later on. And then we can prove that these guys are orthogonal to each other and normalized. And all you need to do to prove that this is true is take one of those vectors, take the inner product with another one of these vectors for a different value of n, and then use the canonical commutation relations between A and A dagger, and this is what comes out. It's a little exercise for you if you haven't done it in the past. Here's a proposition, namely the vectors n in are eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian, with eigenvalues En, which are omega n plus 1/2. Again, little exercise to verify this. Given the importance of harmonic oscillators, if you haven't done this before, you should really do this calculation once. Yes, and then one can prove that actually we found what the spectral theorem guarantees exists, namely a complete eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian. So we've diagonalized the Hamiltonian now. From this, by the way, now that we have this eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, I leave it to you as an exercise, I didn't write it up, you can now work out what the A operator is as a matrix, as an infinite by infinite matrix. You can do this now. All you have to do is take one of those vectors, then the A operator, and then another one of those vectors on the left, and then you get the n, let's say this m in, and here's n im, and here's in, and here's the A operator. And then you get the matrix element of the A operator in that basis, right? The n m matrix element. And do you know how that looks like as a matrix? It looks like this. We then have that A in equal to, let's see, we have 0 on the diagonal. How do we know that? Well, it's because if we have here an A, and then we have an N in over there, then we have an unequal number of A and A daggers in this. And that means that there's always going to be an A surviving, which will annihilate to the right, or an A dagger surviving, which annihilates to the left, and the whole thing is 0. But not so if the n is one larger than the m over there. And what you then get is that this is here square root of 1 square root of 2 factorial, square root of 3 factorial, etc., and the rest is 0. And you can then take the Hermitian conjugate of that, which is really just a transpose, and then multiply a dagger minus a dagger a, and you get it's the identity matrix. But only if you leave it going forever. If you were to do a finite dimensional truncation, it wouldn't be true. Couldn't be true, right? Because the trace of the commutator is always 0. The argument goes like this. If you have a dagger minus a dagger a equal to the identity operator, then you would, in this were finite dimensions, so in finite dimension n, we have that the trace of a dagger minus the trace of a dagger a equal to the trace of 1. And so therefore we have that this is of course 0 because of the cyclicity of the trace, and this is n, so we have a contradiction here. But in infinite dimensions, just try it out, it actually works. Right. So we found now a concrete representation of the A's, of the A daggers, of the Hamiltonian in terms of actual infinite dimensional matrices. The Hamiltonian, of course, in that same basis, the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, how does the Hamiltonian look like? H hat in is equal to, what would it be? Well, it has to be diagonal, it's its eigenbasis after all, right? And then what's the first eigenvalue? 1/2 omega. 1/2 h bar omega, right? So it's 1/2 omega. And the next one is 3/2 omega, right? And then we have 5/2 omega and so on. That's how this looks like. Okay, so now everything is completely concrete. We have the complete solution to our quantum harmonic oscillator because we have a complete, we have a representation of our A in and A in dagger operators in terms of matrices. And then the A of t is expressed at all times in terms of the A in operators. The q hat of t, the p hat of t, the Hamiltonian of t are all expressed in terms of some functions of time and the A in operators. So therefore, everything can now be expressed in terms of matrix valued functions of time. Okay, so what do we have? We have we constructed this basis of the Hilbert space. You know, we could have chosen any basis of the Hilbert space, but we chose for convenience the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian before the interaction kicks in. This is a legal basis that you can use anytime you want, right? But it happens to be the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian before the driving force kicks in. So what we have, the Hamiltonian is constant for early times before the driving force kicks in, and it's this matrix up there in that basis. Then it has one eigenbasis for all of these early times, namely the basis of the n in, and in that basis, this is the matrix. Then we can expand every arbitrary vector in the Hilbert space, let's call it gamma, in that basis. Right? So every state of our quantum harmonic oscillator is a linear combination of these n in vectors here with some coefficients gamma n. So for example, we might start our harmonic oscillator in the fifth excited state. So the state of the harmonic oscillator is 5 in. It's a particular vector in the Hilbert space. Then how does it evolve? How does it evolve over time as the driving force kicks in? Yeah, you're shaking your head. It's not evolving, right? That's the point. It's the Heisenberg picture. So the force can shake and rattle the harmonic oscillator as much as it wants, but the state is not going to move because it's the Heisenberg picture. The state is frozen. So what we would expect is And that's now very important because it contradicts our intuition. We have to upgrade our intuition. From the Schrödinger picture where we say, ah, the operators are fixed, but the states evolve in time. No, not here, right? Here, it's the Heisenberg picture. The state is frozen. So the driving force that does whatever it can, it might be rattling very much, right, on the harmonic oscillator, but it's not going to shake the state. It's always going to be gamma. It's always going to be the fifth excited state of the initial Hamiltonian. But then if we look at that same state after the driving force is done, and the same Hilbert space vector, but now we may be interested in whether that vector is still eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. And maybe not. Right? It has no reason, in fact, to be still eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. Because the Hamiltonian will have changed. It's the Heisenberg picture, after all. The Q changes, the P changes, the Hamiltonian changes. So after the driving force is done, the Hamiltonian will be a different operator. And if we keep the basis N in, the matrix of the Hamiltonian will look different. And it will no longer be even diagonal in that basis. And our vector and in 5, a 5 in, that vector is generally no longer even an eigenvector of our operator. This shouldn't be exotic. In the Schrödinger picture, we hold the observable operator fixed and the state is evolving. So if it starts out as an eigenvector of the operator, like the energy, then after some evolution, it may no longer be an eigenstate to, let's say, the Hamiltonian. Here, in the Heisenberg picture, well, the vector can't change, but the operator changes. And so now, no wonder that the vector is no longer an eigenvector to the Hamiltonian. It's not because the vector changed, it's because the Hamiltonian changed. Right? Same thing, just looked at it, looking at it from either the Schrödinger or the Heisenberg picture. Right. Now, let's look at the time after the driving force has done its thing. Now, once the driving force kicks in, the Hamiltonian starts to change. But after the driving force is finished, so at T larger capital T, the Hamiltonian no longer changes anymore. At least that's what we expect. Let's see what really happens. The Hamiltonian then reads, Hamiltonian is equal to omega A dagger of T, A of T plus 1/2. And then the term with the driving force is gone because the driving force is zero by assumption after the driving force finishes at capital T. So, what do we have? Well, we know that at late times, after the driving force is done, the A of T is given by A out times e to the power minus I omega T. So therefore, we can spell out what this actually is at late times, after the driving force is done. It's simply A out times the phase factor, and here we have A out dagger times the complex conjugate of that phase factor. And the 1/2 is carried forward. And then what we obtain is that the Hamiltonian at times larger than capital T is given by omega A dagger out, A out plus 1/2. It has the same form as the Hamiltonian had before the driving force kicked in, but now it's the A out operators in here. And the A out operators are not the same as the A in operators. They differ by J naught. Right? A out is A in plus J naught. This is the change in the Hamiltonian that we need to take into account. But reassuringly, we found that the Hamiltonian is again constant. It's a constant matrix, right? Because it's a fixed matrix. It's A in, A out is A in plus J naught. J naught being a fixed number times the identity operator, right? So after the driving force has finished, again, the Hamiltonian is constant. No wonder the energy is constant after the driving force has finished. So now we have the Hamiltonian after its time evolution. And it's constant again. This invites to diagonalize it. Let us look at what the eigenvectors now are. What's the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian after the driving force is done? We can do this with exactly the same construction as we did for the Hamiltonian before, because everything is the same except that the in subscript is replaced by the out subscript. Oh, just a sec. I think I may have. I'm too far here. Yeah, no, it's good. Okay. And what do we get then when we compare the before the interaction, the time before the driving force kicks in, to the time after the driving force kicks in? Well, lots of questions that we can now answer because we have the complete solution of everything. We can ask, what about the motion? What's going on? What is the expectation value of the position operator, for example, doing as a function of time? We should be able to calculate this. In particular, if we started out with the harmonic oscillator, for example, in the ground state, then we would expect that after some shaking, the position expectation is oscillating. In fact, it is supposed to oscillate with the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. So we would expect that before the driving force kicks in, Q bar of t is zero if we start out in the ground state. But after the driving force is done, this thing should be oscillatory with the sine wave structure, with the frequency of omega, the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. Then we should see the phenomenon of resonance in there, that J naught plays a key role in this. J naught being the coefficient of the Fourier transform of the driving force at the resonance frequency omega. Then we can ask, how much energy has the driving force pumped into the harmonic oscillator? In other words, how much radiation energy has our charge and current distribution in the antenna produced? And we can ask, what are the new energy eigenstates after the driving force is done? What's the eigenbasis after the driving force is done, in terms of the eigenbasis of the energy before the driving force kicked in? Now, we have the complete solution for all the matrices, so we could start with whatever state we want for the harmonic oscillator. It doesn't have to be the ground state. We solved the complete thing. But for simplicity, let's start with the ground state. This is also a very important case for cosmology and generally for quantum field theory, where you start with a clean slate and then you put a few particles in there. Or even out of the vacuum, you can create particles. So it's nice to start with the lowest energy state, because later on we will work with the vacuum state in quantum field theory. So let's assume that our system starts out, our quantum harmonic oscillator starts out in its ground state, which is the zero in vector. And let's give this thing a name, let's call it gamma. So gamma is the state in which the system starts out, and therefore it's also the state in which the system ends, because it's the Heisenberg picture. Then we can calculate what the motion of the harmonic oscillator is doing. Remember, Q bar stands for the expectation value of Q hat. So we have the state of the system frozen, and the time-evolving position operator. We want to know what is the expectation value. So what is Q again? Gamma. Gamma is the initial state of, is the state of our harmonic oscillator, and we chose it to be the ground state of the harmonic oscillator before the driving force kicks in, so it's a zero in. And there too. What is Q hat? Remember, we can express Q hat in terms of the A and A dagger of T. And that's the expression. This is Q hat in terms of A and A dagger. We established that earlier. Then let's evaluate this at early times and then at late times. At early times, A of T is simply A in times the phase factor, and A dagger is A dagger in times the phase factor. And this is zero, because this operator annihilates that, and that operator annihilates this. Right? Because this is like A dagger in acting on this. It's the same as A in, it's the same as A in acting on that, and then the adjoint of it. So remember this, the A's are annihilating to the right, the A daggers are annihilating to the left. So in order to have something non-zero, You always need an A in on the left and an A dagger on the right. Okay, so we find it's a zero, which is what we would expect. The harmonic oscillator prepared in its ground state has a position expectation value of zero. It's fluctuating around zero. So if we were to calculate the expectation value of Q squared, we would get a finite value. But the expectation value itself of the position is zero. It's just as likely to be left as to be right of the origin. All right, so this is because the harmonic oscillator started in its ground state. Now, what do we obtain for the position expectation of the Hamiltonian of our quantum harmonic oscillator later on? Again, same expression, but now we want to evaluate that at some later time t, so larger than zero. So Q hat of t is again expressed in terms of the A and A daggers. And at later times, when the driving force has ended, then the A of t is simply A out times phase factor. And this one is A dagger out times phase factor. And now, what can we do? You see, the A out somehow acts on the zero in, but does it annihilate it? No, we don't know any such thing, right? We only know that the A in annihilates the zero in. But we don't know if the A out is annihilating the zero in. In fact, it doesn't. Remember, this is, in general, not the same as the A in operator. It would only be the same if there was no driving force. So we have to work out what this action actually is. And for that, we simply express the A out operator in terms of the A in operator. Remember that A out is A in plus J naught. So A out is A in plus J naught. And A out dagger is A dagger in plus J naught star. Now we can work with it. And what do we get? We get that the A in annihilates, the A dagger in annihilates. So those two terms drop out. And we're just left with J naught terms. And they're going to be these two terms. Now you see, this is an expression that we can rewrite using what we know about J naught. J naught, remember, is a Fourier transform. It's the Fourier transform of J of t times the Fourier factor. And when we express that, when we plug all of that in there, then I leave it to you as a little exercise. If we express J naught as the integral that it is, then we obtain it's this. The sign arises because we have two terms, and they will come in with two different prefactors, one positive, one negative. Therefore, we get the sine function over here. So this now is the answer to the question, how the harmonic oscillator oscillates after the driving force is done. This is the position expectation value as, or the Q expectation value as a function of time, as a function of t. Now let's look at this. It is two things to note in there. One is that it's a Fourier sine transform, because we have a J of t, and then we have the sine of omega of t prime and sine of omega t prime. So it's a Fourier sine transform, as we would expect. We are picking out the resonance frequency. We are picking out how much of the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator is contained in the driving force. But secondly, we also see that this is a sine function which oscillates with frequency omega, right? The sine of t omega. So therefore, disregarding that there's an integral over t prime, overall, all the terms that contribute to this integral, for all t prime, they oscillate in t with frequency omega. So this is what we would expect. This is telling us that the harmonic oscillator, after having been driven, will oscillate with frequency omega. And it's going to be, the expectation value is going to be a linear combination of sine waves with frequency omega. And the amplitude of those guys depends on the Fourier sine transform of the driving force at the resonance frequency. So the driving force's strength in, at the resonance frequency determines how much the oscillator is going to oscillate, and it will oscillate at the resonance frequency. Okay, so here the issue of resonance again. I think I've said these things already. So the amplitude of the excited motion of the oscillator is determined by J naught, as this equation just above showed. We expect that the driving force is most efficient at creating a large J naught if it oscillates at roughly the oscillator's natural frequency omega, and that of that's of course what we see. Remember the value of J naught. J naught was by definition the Fourier transform of the driving force. This is the Fourier transform evaluated at omega, right? At omega, the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. And it is indeed, strictly speaking, the Fourier transform, because that integral could also be written as running from minus infinity to plus infinity, because the driving force is actually vanishing outside that time interval, so we might as well run that integral all the way. Okay, so as expected, the more of the frequency omega is contained in the driving force, the larger is going to be J naught, and therefore the larger are going to be the oscillations of the position that the harmonic oscillator will do. Now, energy expectation. We pump energy into the quantum harmonic oscillator by driving it. What about the energy before the driving starts? Well, what's the energy expectation value before the driving starts? Here's the state of the quantum system. Here's the Hamiltonian. At initial time, the Hamiltonian is omega times A dagger in, A in plus 1/2. And what do we see? This A in deletes this term, so that term goes away. So we're just left with omega half. That's the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillator. Well, we started with the ground state, so no wonder. Now, for times larger than capital T, so when the driving force has ended, the expectation value of the energy is what? Let's see, the state hasn't changed. The Hamiltonian has changed, though. The Hamiltonian now, after the driving ended, is omega A dagger out, A out, plus 1/2. But the state here is still gamma. It's still zero in. So again, we have to play this game and say, I don't know how A out acts on zero in, but I know how to express A out in terms of A in. Let's do this. So we express A out in terms of A in, namely it's simply A in plus J naught. A out dagger is A in dagger plus J naught star. And now we are in business, because we see that A in annihilates the A dagger, annihilates, and we're just left with the J naught and J naught star terms. So what we get is that the energy of the harmonic oscillator after the driving ends is given by this expression, where J naught and J naught star are just numbers multiplied with the identity operator. So therefore, the energy is given by 1/2 omega, the ground state energy, plus this. So the amount of energy that the quantum harmonic oscillator has picked up is given by the modulus of J naught squared. Again, resonance. J naught is the bigger, the closer we are to resonance with the driving force. So we have an elevated energy of our harmonic oscillator. All right, this is just saying in so many words that we can use this in quantum field theory, where it has the interpretation of charges and currents in an antenna, pumping energy into the electromagnetic quantum field in the form of photons. Now, remember that the zero out state is not equal to the zero in state. The zero in state being the initial state that we prepared our system in. Now, the ground state, zero out, of the Hamiltonian after the force acted. Hamiltonian after the force acted is, of course, this expression here, has eigenvalue omega half. So the ground state of the Hamiltonian before the force acted had energy h bar omega half, and the ground state of the Hamiltonian after the force acted is still omega half. It's just that those two Hilbert space vectors are no longer the same. Not because they evolved. No, they're always the same. It's Heisenberg picture. No, it's because the Hamiltonian changed. So the eigenvector, the lowest eigenvalue eigenvector of one Hamiltonian, the early one, is not the same as the lowest eigenvalue eigenvector of the late Hamiltonian because it's two different operators. So let's look at the relationship here between these guys. What is the relationship between the zero-in and the zero-out vectors, between the ground states of the Hamiltonian early and the Hamiltonian operator late? What do we know? Well, we know that A-out annihilates the zero-out vector. That's by definition, right? We construct the basis vectors of the eigenbasis of the late Hamiltonian in exactly the same way as we constructed the basis vectors of the early Hamiltonian. So what do we have then? We have that A out annihilates the zero out vector. So the A out operator acting on the state of our quantum system is the A out operator acting on the initial, the zero in. Let's see what that is. How does A out act on the zero in? Remember, we already used this in the calculations a little earlier. We had terms where A out was acting on zero in. And then what did we do? We expressed A out in terms of A in plus J naught. Let's do that again, just to zoom into that particular relationship. So what we then obtain is that A out acting on zero in is A in plus J naught zero in. But this operator annihilates that one. So we are just left with J naught gamma, which is to say J naught zero in. So what we find is that the A out operator does not annihilate the zero in vector, which is to say that the A out, the zero out vector is not the zero in vector, which is what we expected, right? We expected to find that what used to be the ground state of the early Hamiltonian is no longer the ground state of the late Hamiltonian. That's all we found here. But we also found something super important for later on, and just generally for all of physics, which is that the zero-out vector acting on the zero-in vector gives us a number times the zero-in vector. In other words, the zero-in vector is an eigenvector of A out with a certain eigenvalue, which is J naught. Such states, we will soon see, have a special name. They occur all over the place, and they are the reason why, in the Schrödinger equation, we don't have a wave function collapse, even though the Schrödinger equation can describe how our electron interacts with another system, namely the electromagnetic field, very strongly. Right? Remember from the beginning of the lecture today, an electron goes along its way happily, undisturbed, until it comes into a region with lots of electric and magnetic fields. And it's being shaken around and all of that, strongly interacting with the electromagnetic field, but not decohering. Wave function not collapsing. Why? It's because of the nature of these states that are eigenvectors of the annihilation operators, so-called coherent states. We'll see more about this in a moment. So, what kind of excited state is the ground state, the early ground state at late times? So, remember we prepared the system, our quantum harmonic oscillator, in the ground state. So, the state of the system, gamma, is the zero-in state. But we just showed that the gamma, the zero-in state, is an eigenvector of the A out operator with eigenvalue J naught. And that's what we just calculated. We showed that A out is not annihilating the zero in vector. No, it's reproducing it with a number. In general, whenever you see one of those A operators, one of those annihilation operators, and you see that a vector on which they act is an eigenvector with some eigenvalue, then you know that the state that you're talking about is a coherent state by definition, right? So eigenvectors of the annihilation operators are called coherent states. Keep in mind that the A operator is not self-adjoint. A is not a dagger, otherwise it couldn't have non-trivial commutation relations. And correspondingly, these guys are not real. The J naught is generally a complex number. So don't be surprised by that. Coherent states. By the way, if you still believe that the A operators are annihilating particles from something you've heard before, now is the time to give up on that belief. A operators do not generally annihilate particles. They don't reduce the number of particles by one, as one is sometimes told. They don't. Just look at this example. You have an annihilation operator acting on a vector, reproducing that exact vector. Whatever number of particles this describes, it's going to be the same, right? So the annihilation operator is sometimes reducing the number of excitations, but not in general. In fact, you can write down examples where it increases the number of the expected number of particles in a state. You apply A to a state, and you get a state with a larger expected number of particles, of excitations in there. So be careful about this. It's only in the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator that this is. If you act on basis vectors, then it does it. Otherwise, it generally doesn't. Anyway, so the eigenvectors to the annihilation operators are called coherent states. Coherent states are super important because they are states that saturate the uncertainty relation. If psi is an eigenstate of A, of an annihilation operator, if psi is a coherent state, then the product of the uncertainties of Q and P is h bar half, which is as small as it can possibly be. So it's on the boundary of the uncertainty principle, saturates the uncertainty equation, uncertainty principle. This means that if what we are dealing with is the electromagnetic field, for example. Now I'm coming back to this question that we started with today. If we're talking, for example, about the electromagnetic field, then our harmonic oscillators describe not positions and momenta. No, for the electromagnetic field, these two are basically electric field modes and magnetic field modes. And then having a coherent state means that our uncertainty in the electric field and the uncertainty in the magnetic field, I mean the product of the uncertainties, is as small as it can possibly be. Which is to say that these states are as close to classical as can be, because the quantum uncertainty is as small as can be. This has super important consequences. It means, coming back to our antenna, if you create electromagnetic fields through an antenna by shooting currents up and down an antenna or having some general space-time dependent charge current distribution, classical charge current distribution. So if you have charges and currents that can be described classically and you use them to create an electromagnetic field, then our math here kicks in and we can deduce that the mode oscillators of the electric and the magnetic fields are going to be excited, but they're going to end up, after the antenna is done, they're going to end up in coherent states. All of the modes are going to be in coherent states, therefore as classical as possible. Therefore, the electric and magnetic fields are going to have, the product of them anyway, has going to have the smallest uncertainty product possible, the smallest phase space volume of uncertainty. So that means that if you generate electromagnetic fields through an antenna, they are going to come out looking as classical as electromagnetic fields could possibly look like, with the electric field quantum uncertainty and the electric field magnetic uncertainty and the electromagnetic fields magnetic field strength uncertainty being as small as it can possibly be. So in other words, as far as the quantum field theory is concerned, if you have states with very small delta E or very small delta B, so small uncertainty in electric field, small uncertainty in magnetic field, it basically means that you have almost eigenstates of the electric field operators, almost eigenstates of magnetic field eigenvectors. See, if you have an eigenstate of an observable, not just electric and magnetic fields, but generally in quantum theory, if you have an observable Q and you have an eigenstate of Q, what's the uncertainty in Q going to be? Zero, right? If you're in an eigenstate of an observable, you can predict that the next measurement is going to come up with the eigenvalue for sure. There's not going to be any uncertainty in this. So having small uncertainty means you almost have an eigenvector. Almost have an eigenvector, right? Okay, so what we have derived here is the following. When you drive a quantum field such as the electromagnetic field using charges and currents, the state of the electromagnetic field of all of its mode oscillators come out to be in coherent states, which are almost classical states, where the electric field and the magnetic field have as small as possible quantum fluctuations. And very importantly, this means that the state of the electromagnetic quantum field is almost an eigenstate for the E and the B operators. Super important for this question now. Remember what we were after here. We said in the Schrödinger equation, we can write down here, for example, electric and magnetic fields. And the electron might be shaken around by those. It might be forced to oscillate, to rotate around magnetic field lines, for example. So the electron is strongly interacting with the quantum system of the electromagnetic field. And yet, Schrödinger equation is still basically valid. We still basically have no decoherence in this, in many circumstances anyway, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, where you just write down a potential here. And why is that? Well, it's because in here, when you write in the potential an electric field and or a magnetic field, then in principle, these guys are going to be operative, right? So in principle, we would have here something like, for example, P hat dot B hat, something like this, right? So we would have the magnetic field, for example, operator valued. And that is an operator on the Hilbert space of the quantum field. Or we could have the electric field and so on. But with very good approximation, we can replace the operator by the expectation value of the operator multiplied with the identity operator. Why is that? Well, it's because it's almost an eigenstate. You see, if you have that, let's say you have an operator B hat, and it acts on a state, let's call it phi, by being approximately some number B, so this is in R. I mean, this is really vectorial, of course, but that doesn't really matter. This is a Hilbert space vector. This is an eigenvalue, and this. So you see, if delta B is small, so if delta B small, then you can show that B, that phi, I mean delta is small for phi. Then you can show that phi is almost an eigenvector to our operator, right? But that means that wherever the operator B hat occurs, we can replace it by the number B times the identity operator, as long as this operator acts on this vector here, right? As long as it acts on this vector here, we can replace it. If it were an actual eigenvector, then for sure we can do it, right? Because the action of the operator is the action of the identity operator times the eigenvalue. But if the uncertainty is small, then it's almost that. That's super important here in the Schrödinger equation. Because it means that we can write here effectively the Schrödinger equation where We just have the p hat operator, and this is just multiplying the identity operator for the quantum field theory. And that means that the quantum field of the electromagnetic quantum field and the Schrödinger electron are not going to get entangled. You see, this is the interaction Hamiltonian between two quantum systems. I mean, without that, right? It's the interaction Hamiltonian between the quantum system of the electron and the quantum system of the quantum field. This guy acts as an operator on the Hilbert space of the Schrödinger electron. And this guy acts as a quantum operator on the Hilbert space of the quantum field. Now, if, however, the quantum field is in a state that's almost an eigenstate to p hat, then we can replace the operator by expectation value times the identity. Right? This number here is the expectation value of b. But that means that the interaction Hamiltonian is of the form p hat tensor the identity. But such an interaction Hamiltonian is not entangling. You can put a number here if you like, it doesn't matter. Such an interaction Hamiltonian is not entangling. If you apply that to a separable state, then you get a separable state out of it. If you do the time evolution of this one, of this, if you calculate the time evolution generated by this Hamiltonian, it will not turn a separable unentangled state into an entangled state. And since the two systems therefore don't get entangled, there is no wave function collapse. Now, the thing is, we're out of time, but I wrote up for you here the exact calculation of what I just said in words. So I wrote up for you here the calculation that shows that if you have two systems that start out unentangled and then are exposed to a generic interaction Hamiltonian, such as p hat times b hat, so it's just some interaction Hamiltonian, one operator tensor the other operator, in one Hilbert space, the other Hilbert space. If you calculate the time evolution of this thing, then in general, previously unentangled states will become entangled. And I show you that if the interaction Hamiltonian is not A tensor B, with both are being operators, but if the interaction Hamiltonian is simply just A tensor times something proportional to the identity operator, then this is not entangling. But you see, if an interaction doesn't lead to entanglement, then no wave function collapse happens. Because then you can have that both systems still evolve unitarily. If you trace over one, the other one still evolves unitarily. So all of that is in there, but I'm afraid that would take us too long. In any case, this is super important then for issues of quantum information, for the transmission of quantum information in interactions, and in particular in quantum field theory. I myself and my group, and quite a number of people here in Waterloo, are working on that sort of thing. The transmission of classical and quantum information through quantum fields, and for that, this sort of thing is very important. But the bottom line is this. If you want to know more about this, then just read on in the lecture notes. Okay, there's one more slide I should explain. The point I wanted to make answering the question from the beginning of the lecture is that the Schrödinger equation is okay with adding some electric potential or magnetic field or whatever in there classically under one condition. And that condition is that these electric fields and magnetic fields must be fundamentally under the hood, when you really look at it as a quantum field, these electric and magnetic fields must have very small quantum fluctuations. They must be almost in eigenstates of their operators. Because if they are not in the eigenstates of their operators, then you really have that the electron is interacting non-trivially with the electromagnetic field, and it will decohere, and the whole thing falls apart. The Schrödinger equation is not always valid with just putting electric and magnetic fields there. In fact, there's a whole discipline which is concerned with just the case when the Schrödinger equation fails here. When you have to take into account that the E's and the B's, or the capital A, that they are really quantum field theoretical objects with, which are operators, and where the state of the field is not accidentally a coherent state or anything close to a coherent state. And that field is quantum optics. Quantum optics is concerned with situations in which the quantum field is in a state that's not a coherent state, that's not anywhere near to a coherent state, where you have truly quantum phenomena happening there between photons on one hand and electrons and other particles on the other hand. There are big textbooks about quantum optics and so on. So I'm just filling in something that you may have missed in the first course on quantum mechanics. Schrödinger equation, you can't always just put electric and magnetic fields there. In general, they are quantum fields, and then you have the interaction between an electron, which has its own Hilbert space and operators, and the quantum field theory of the electromagnetic field, which has its own, and these guys get entangled, and there's going to be wave function collapse. That's the generic situation, which of course we study here how to do. So one important thing still I need to tell you, which has to do with terminology. I leave you here with an exercise, namely show that if alpha is a vector that is an eigenvector of the annihilation operator A, of an annihilation operator A in whatever circumstance, where alpha is some complex number, and we have that as before, the Q hat and the P hat associated to the annihilation operator are given by these combinations, then the expectation value of position is simply given by the real part of this eigenvalue of the coherent state, and the expectation value of the momentum is given by the imaginary part of the eigenvalue of the coherent state. So to recapitulate, the eigenvalue, coherent states are eigenvectors to annihilation operators by definition, right? So you have an annihilation operator, then you have coherent states, they are the eigenvectors to annihilation operators. In fact, the spectrum of the annihilation operator A is the entire complex plane. Every real number, every complex number occurs as eigenvector of the annihilation operator. That's possible because it's not self-adjoint, it's not a normal operator. Okay, now what about the eigenvalue? What I just said here is that the eigenvalue of a coherent state tells you what the position and momentum expectation values are. The real part of the eigenvalue is the position expectation value, and the imaginary part is the momentum expectation value, up to prefactors of something to do with the square root of omega. Okay? So if you get in a coherent state, and this is its eigenvector, and this is its eigenvalue, if a coherent state is an eigenvector to an annihilation operator with an eigenvalue, the real part tells you the position expectation, the imaginary part tells you the momentum expectation. In the case of the electromagnetic field, the real part would give you the electric field expectation, and the imaginary part would give you the magnetic field expectation. Okay. Now, I have to tell you one last definition, that of a squeeze state. What the hell is a squeeze state? You may have heard of squeeze states before. What's their relationship to coherent states? The answer is one person's coherent state is another person's squeeze state in a very precise way. You see, the relationship between A and A dagger operators depends on omega. Right? So if you have one fixed harmonic oscillator, it has one fixed value of omega. And therefore, you have a fixed relationship between the A and A dagger operators on one hand and the Q and the P. And that relationship involves omega. Now imagine you take your operator A, you take a coherent state for it, you take alpha here, and then you say, okay, but what if I'm looking at a different harmonic oscillator? Not the one with the omega, But I'm looking at a harmonic oscillator with a frequency omega tilde. Then what? You see, if you're looking at the coherent state of one harmonic oscillator, but apply it in a system of another harmonic oscillator, that's what you call a squeeze state then. Okay? And how does it look like? If you look at the uncertainty principle, you have delta Q, delta P, and then this hyperbola is delta Q, delta P equal to h bar half. That's the uncertainty principle. And this is the allowed region here. Allowed region. Now, a coherent state for a harmonic oscillator is sitting somewhere there. Or let's just put it here. It's sitting somewhere there because the product of delta Q and delta P is as small as it can be. It's sitting right on the boundary. Now, if you change your harmonic oscillator to a different frequency, you're changing the relationship between the A's and the Q's and the P's. So you're redefining what you mean by Q, you're redefining what you mean by P. And the effect of that is that if you change your omega there, you're moving to this place or that place or that place or this or that, depending on whether you increase or decrease the value of your omega. If your omega tilde is larger or smaller than your omega. So if you take a coherent state of one harmonic oscillator, but then calculate as if you were dealing with a harmonic oscillator of a different omega, if you do the association here to a different omega, then you get again a state of minimum uncertainty product, but it sits somewhere else on that hyperbola. And now why would it be called squeeze state? Well, it's called squeeze state because in the extreme case, let's say you're up here, it means delta Q is very small at the expense of having delta P really large. So you're squeezing delta Q at the expense of having large delta P. And you can also squeeze the other way. You have a large delta Q, but for that you have a small delta P. And you can produce in the lab also squeeze states. It is possible. For example, you may want, in quantum optics, you may want to produce a state in which the electric field fluctuates very, very little. So you want a very small delta E, but that will come at the cost of a large delta B. Right? And so similarly in ordinary quantum mechanics as well. Okay, so these are squeeze states. So squeeze states are nothing to worry about. If you just redefine which harmonic oscillator you deal with, then you can always recenter that. It's just the same state. It's just looked at from the perspective of a different harmonic oscillator. Okay, and we are done for today. Yes?
So like in the AEM state, you're at a specific harmonic oscillator, and then the driving force happens, and the Hamiltonian changes. So is AEM a coherent state, and then AL a squeeze state? Is that wrong?
No, not in this case. In fact, both are... coherent states. Because we started out in our calculation here with a coherent state too. Because remember, the ground state of the harmonic oscillator before the driving force kicked in, that ground state was annihilated by the A-in operator. So it was, by definition, a coherent state. And what is its position expectation value? Well, let's see. It's the real part of zero. Zero. What's its momentum expectation value? Real part of zero. It's zero, right? And that's how it should be for the ground state. So we started with a coherent state and we end up with a coherent state. Yeah. It's different mechanisms that will create squeeze states. And in fact, in cosmology, we will see that, yeah, you get squeeze states. The expansion of the space-time will produce squeeze states. Okay. Right, and then this whole decoherence business, as I said, I wrote up to you in so many words, but also some calculations there. If you have any questions about this, then just read it and then ask me if you have any questions. But I think we shouldn't really go much longer. Okay, thanks for having so much patience with me that I'm going like 25 minutes over time. Okay, see you on Tuesday.